Good evening. Thanks for coming out. It's my pleasure and honor to kick off the series of God's Good Design. And I'll start it off this way. I am a Christian who happens to be a heart surgeon, not a heart surgeon who happens to be a Christian. I get my identity from identifying with Christ, not what I am or what I'm able to do in my work. But having said that, I'm not Led Zeppelin. But I can tell you that the first Led Zeppelin song I learned on guitar was Heartbreaker. So wherever Rod is, we got that one started. Do we have my slides up? And what we're examining today is God's design and what he's made. Do we find evidence that it is an accident, what we observe and what we study in science? Or is it just the case that we can discern some element of pre-planning in what God has made? Does nature reveal the hand of God? Surgeons tend to be kind of simple creatures because we tend to try to put a lot of complexity into little pithy things so that we can remember them, because we have a lot on our minds. We try to keep it simple. And one of the things we say is to cut is to cure. So every problem is, right, if you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? So if you're a surgeon, well, you're going to cut it. It's going to make it better, right? The way to heal is with stainless steel. We have one other one that we teach the residents that they like. It's called, when in doubt, cut it out. You'll never regret cutting it out. And the one we don't ordinarily tell an audience or a crowd like this is that a surgeon's trademark is never in doubt, but not always right. Okay, so there's a certain persona that comes with it. But I noticed in medical school, as I was training for this, that there was a current of thought that was coming into our professorship. And as we studied neuroscience, we looked at the complexities of the brain. And the professor, Wolfgang, told us, well, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. He goes, that's wrong. You're not really thinking. All that's happening in there is neurotransmission, just chemicals going around. There's no plan. There's no design. You are an accident of the universe. And you don't think, therefore you am. You neurotransmit, therefore I am. So that was his pithy thing. And we see evidence of that thinking kind of percolating through in our culture. This is a heart-lung machine. It, for a short time, can simulate what your heart and lungs do in oxygenating the blood, correcting the pH, that is the acidity and base chemistry of it, the oxygen content, the CO2, the temperature, a myriad of things that have to be just right with all the chemicals in your blood. And across the table from me, one of my things I like to do when students come to the operating room is we banter, we talk about things. And this one particular young lady was giving me a lot of pushback about pretty much everything I was saying. She goes, well, that's just your opinion. Now, we talked a little bit about, like, general life things, but also some surgery. And she goes, well, that's just your opinion. You know, people think differently about this. And it was, by the end of this, it was starting to get on my nerves a little bit. And there was a big crowd, and everyone's listening to this as we are kind of going at it, this student telling this heart surgeon about how things ought to be done. And we're on the heart-lung machine here, and if the time comes, probably the critical case of the operation is not even just the cutting and sewing we do while we're on bypass, but the coming off bypass. Then you find out, one of the reasons I like heart surgery, is you find out right then if you did a good job or not. If the heart that you just worked on can support life and you don't need this machine anymore. The machine is like slow death. It lasts about 4 hours, but slowly it can't replicate what your heart and lungs actually do. But if you work fast enough, you can get by. So after her telling me about how her opinion is equal to mine, I was getting a little irritated. I just stood back and I said, okay, it's time to come off bypass. Your opinion's equal to mine, right? Why don't you tell the perfusionist the pressure, the drugs, and the oxygen levels you need to come off? Got real quiet all of a sudden. Got a little pasty. She didn't say too much after that. Because the point was that there is, behind our reality, a design that we know is there and is detectable. But the little conflict we had has to do with our perception of the nature of truth. And some historians of science have broken up our thinking about the nature of how we think about truth. Our epistemology is a big word for how we know what we know. In the three patterns, one is the pre-modern, modern, and post-modern. The pre-modern idea basically is this. The universe is out there, and it's our job as humankind to find where we fit in. The universe is already made. There's a moral vector to it. There's a physical reality. And our job to do well in our life, for our life to flourish, for humankind to do well, is to fit into what's already been made. And that truth is given by revelation. That is, someone tells you. The priest tells you. The Bible tells you. Your parents tell you. Your professors tell you. And you take that as truth, and you find your place in it, and you excel in that environment. Modern thinking started, some people say, with Descartes. I think therefore I am, because he started saying, you know what? Sure, there's a physical reality out there, but there's something here that I'm going to add to that. Okay? I think, therefore I am. And he started this thought, we should observe, we should see what nature has to tell us. And modern man started exploring, started doing dissections, started observing in physics, started expanding the realm of human reason, and applied science was born. And these two views, the pre-modern and modern views, share this, that they believe there was a teleology. Teleology means a plan. That there is a plan out there if we can find it. There is a single truth. There's a unity of the nature of truth, so that if we can find truth, if we can find the scientific answer, that will be true for all people at all times, and we are going to go on this journey to get a unity of knowledge. Okay? It sounds like a good idea, and I think that it very much was for modern man to launch into. So we can summarize like this. Pre-modern thinking was that God did have a teleology. God did put his imprint into creation, and because God is a rational God, we know that, he made a rational universe. It's interesting that science as we know it, the science that allows me to do what I do, allows you to drive your car, allows you to use your cell phone, allows you to have GPS, allows me to track my kids, because we still pay for their cell phone. That's the price they pay for having that, okay? All of that comes because we believe that there's a rationality behind what we do, that the physical laws that are operating right now will operate tomorrow. They operate uniformly everywhere, and that there is a rational universe that makes sense. You know, modern science that brought us these technological wonders appeared in human history only one place and one time. It did not occur in ancient China, that was way ahead of the West at some point. Did not occur in Islam. Did not occur in any of these other societies because of the worldview that comes from understanding that God is a rational God and that we can walk steps after him. Therefore, we can know that there's a predictable law in laws, physical laws, that allow us to predict what we can make and allow us to do heart surgery and space travel. This occurred during the Enlightenment. These names will be familiar to you. Johann Kepler observed the periodical nature of the movement of the planets around the sun, and he saw that they moved at different speeds depending on how far away they were from the sun. These guys are really smart. I could never figure this out. But he said, you know, look at that. It actually, you can predict the velocity of the planet and its position by the integral of the area proscribed by the arc of the ellipse of the orbit of the planet. Okay? So the integral of that area, you see, the shaded area there is going to be constant for every planetary body as it circles the Earth. Oh, that's something that's like math. He could see it. And Newton, and I know there's mechanical engineers in here, so I don't want to overstep my bounds, but in the differential equation, he saw that momentum, it's looked at as a derivative of time, momentum dt, is actually acceleration. And force would equal, therefore, mass times acceleration. With that prediction, modern science was set on its way. Einstein himself said it like this: the incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Isn't it amazing that we can predict using math? Why should that be? Because there's a rational God who is the author of these things. But as we look forward, though, as is the human condition, we started beginning a little bit proud here, because the 17th century doctrine of necessity of reason, that is, there is a rational God and we're following his steps after him, has changed to slowly giving way to the sufficiency of reason. Peter Medawar is a Nobel Prize winning Oxford professor who allows me to do what I do. He helped put my kids through college because he described the fundamentals of immunology that allow transplantation to occur. So he's no lightweight, but he saw this. He's also a historian of science, and he said this, that there is a little change here. Sure, we love science. Science is necessary. But the next step was science is all we need. Instead of just becoming a tool, science became a worldview, an idol of sorts, where that's the only place we could go for understanding the universe. And gradually, the place where God, first God created and we had a place in it, next God set the universe in motion, it's going by clockwork, he never intervenes, and that's a kind of a deist view, if you've heard that term. And finally, there's only nature. And God got squeezed out of the picture. And now we have science only informing us of, in our epistemology or how we know what we know. Bertrand Russell is a famous intellectual, scientist, philosopher, statesman of the previous generation. And he said, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. He epitomizes this thinking that science is not just necessary, but science is sufficient. Because if science can't describe it, it doesn't exist. I don't care about it. Anyone see the problem with this statement? Is this a statement of science? No. It's a statement of a scientist, but it's not actually a scientific statement. So how would he know this if science is all there is? Well, you can see that it's a self-refuting statement, just like our young medical student who said, everything is relative. That's like saying there are no English sentences, right? It's a self-refuting statement. It's not a statement that happens to be false. It's a statement that cannot possibly be true. And so we see that that is a limitation. That is the step next that we have to look at, because modern man has found that science is not sufficient. Science doesn't give purpose or meaning. And at the end of last century, Nietzsche brought us to this point. He said, you know, we don't need God. God is dead. We have killed him. But Nietzsche also saw what that means, because for most of us, we like to have the science. We like to have the iPhone in your pocket. We like to have the jet travel. But we don't want to see the God that's behind it. But Nietzsche says, no, no, no. If you take God away, you're going to lose something a lot more than this. He says, God is dead. Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the horizon? How did we drink up the sea, he says. And he says, having killed the most noble and mighty among us, that is God, must we not become gods ourselves to be worthy of such an act? That's kind of what we're doing now, because if God is dead, he pointed out that there is no longer an up or down. There is no moral vector anymore in what we do. You have your way, I have my way. As for the right way, the correct way, it does not exist. There are no facts, only interpretations. Without an infinite reference point, we are left with only opinions among ourselves. And which opinion is right? The one that is the loudest and most politically powerful. This is where it takes us. And interestingly, this is the conundrum where modern man finds himself. Is it the case that there is no design and that Nietzsche was right? Or is there a teleology that we can define? This is the central problem. When we start out that the premise of where Nietzsche left us, where there is no God, we tend not to see it. Richard Dawkins is probably the most quoted, most well-known scientist of our day, who is an atheist and speaks about naturalism. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. He says, look out there, I see this. Like Yuri Gagarin, who was the first astronaut, right? Shot him into space. The Russians did. He looked out the window. What did he say? I was right. There's no God. You shot me up here in space, and I don't see him. So there must not be a God, right? That made a lot of sense. But there's a reason behind it. See, Darwin enabled or the thinking that science has disproven God or pushed God to the side or killed him, as Nietzsche says. It has enabled our modern secular culture, secular means the temporary, that is the culture that we have right now, to heave a collective sigh of relief by providing a way to eliminate purpose, meaning, and design. God's good design pushed aside as fundamental features of the world. Why are we so interested to get away from what's obviously true, that there is design there? Why is that? Because we want to take that place of authority. This is Dawkins again. There's probably no God, so stop worrying about it and enjoy your life. Okay, that's a rich statement. We don't have time to go into it, but you can see where he's headed. Religion evolved to help us cope with the reality that we really live in a meaningless universe. I mean, Marx said this. He said, religion did not make man, but man made religion. That we just invented a God of our own in order to make us feel better, a crutch to help us get through life. And we see the results of that in our society today. Because even science now is at risk to the postmodern thinking. If everyone has an opinion, then the authoritative thing is not biology, it is not science, it is not tradition, it is not history, it is not culture. The defining epistemology for truth, how I tell what truth is, my inner feelings. My inner feelings are now decisive for deciding what is true and what is not. And we can see it in the front pages right now. We can see it in our schools. And we see that at my place of work. The Supreme Court has gone so far as to codify that, and this is Anthony Kennedy giving a foundational understanding of what it means to be a human in America. You have the right to define your own concept of existence, your own meaning. You can put that out into the universe, and the mystery of human life, you're entitled to your opinion. And it's equal to everybody else's. We don't know which way is up. Someone wiped away the horizon. And we don't know. Into this chaos, God speaks. He speaks through his creation. He speaks through his word. He is there. And he is not silent. If you have your Bibles with you, turn to Psalm 111. Praise the Lord. I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart, in the company of the upright and in the assembly. That's us now. And I'm pleased to be with you here tonight. Verse 2. Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them. Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them. The God of the Bible is not anti-science. In fact, the foundation of science comes from the Christian worldview that God is the same yesterday, today, tomorrow. He's a rational God, that he makes a universe that is worthy to be studied. This verse is a famous verse, verse 2. Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them. In the late 1800s and early 20th century, the leading physics lab in the world is the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge, where not only was the atom first dissected, but subatomic particles were described, and subatomic particles were demonstrated experimentally. And over the door of the Cavendish Lab is Psalm 111, 2. Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by those who delight in them. Splendid and majestic is his work, and his righteousness endures forever. And God doesn't just put that out in an abstract way, because he ties this knowledge that God made the world to concrete things. Verse 4, he has made his wonders to be remembered. Verse 5, he has given food to those who fear him. This psalm was written to the Jewish nation. And this refers to the manna in the desert that they remember. He ties it to a concrete event and says, yes, you remember the manna? Well, that same God created. Study what he did. He has made known, verse 6, to his people the power of his works. He's made known what he has done to you. And in a parallel that we'll also see in Psalm 19, Psalm 136, another example, In parallel to God creating a physical universe, he also has created a moral universe, a prepositional universe that uses propositions of speech. The word speaks. The works of his hands are truth and justice, verse 7. All of his precepts are sure. So there's a moral law that he speaks through and also what he has made. We're going to take a few minutes to look at some of the aspects of what he has made. Because when we see what people make, you learn something about the maker. This is not an exhaustive list. This is just a few things to pull out as we survey a broad topic of things that will be, in Sunday nights to come, be expounded in more detail. But God's creation is ex nihilo. God's creation is ordered. It is complete. And it reflects the glory of God. Now, Chinese New Year was a couple weeks ago. And there was a young lady, eighth grader, at our dining room table. And she goes to me, why do I have to study Latin? And I said to her, ex nihilo. She goes, from nothing. I said, that's why you study Latin, because you learn theology from it. What does ex nihilo mean? She knew, from nothing. When God says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, he created from nothing. The writer of Hebrews says this, by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen is not made of things which are visible. God created from nothing. Why is that important? If you have your finger, we'll go to a familiar passage. You go back to Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That little statement, many have said, is the most profound statement ever uttered by man that's ever been written down. Why is that? Because it speaks in simplicity, in truth, to all times and all places. Now, picture, we're speaking to a nomadic tribe in the desert. And we're talking about cosmology, which is the science of the beginning, science of creation, the science of why there's something rather than nothing, the most profound topic you can think of. And in this statement, we see the total encapsulating of all of reality. Around the turn of the century, there's a fellow by the name of Herbert Spencer, and he was another one of these British smart guys, philosopher, statesman, scientist, etc., etc. And he, using the full scientific knowledge at that time, which was just exploding as atomic theory was coming out, relativity, these things came out, he said, you know, everything we know in the universe can be expressed as time, force, action, space, and mass. Think of those concepts. What is there that's not that? Because in order to have a physical universe, you've got to have that. You have time, some chronology, space and chronology. You have to have force, something happening, the action that has it occur. Space, that is the three dimensions. Okay, the three dimensions are something. The height, width, depth is something. And mass, some physical stuff in the universe. Look at that verse. In the beginning, time, God, force, created, action, the heavens, space, and the earth, mass. God, in that one sentence, spoke to nomads in the desert in truth and speaks to a 20th century scientist in truth and said, listen, I created from nothing. What does this mean? It means, one, atheism is wrong. There is a God. What about pantheism? God is part of the universe. No, God pre-existed it, right? Jeremiah 10:16, he says, what? The portion of Jacob is not like these things. He is the former to all things. He was before. So pantheism is out. God is not part of the universe. How about humanism? Man is the center. No, man wasn't around. Where were you when I created, says God? So in this one statement, God sets himself apart from all the confusion we said before and says, I stand outside my universe. I am not a prisoner of my universe. I'm not subject to its laws. I set the laws up so you can see what I'm like. But I can intervene in them as I need to make my will known. And God says, I am not subject to what I've made. So, God's creation was intentional. There was nothing before. And time was also created. Some people ask, well, if God created time, then before there was time, what was there? Well, we know God was there. Calvin had a way of saying it. When someone asked him, what was God doing before he created? He said, he was building a place for those who ask such questions. But we know that before time was, that God existed in a triune form, and there was love, there was fellowship, there was purpose, and there was community. God does not need his creation. He did not create us because he was lonely. He stands apart, above, transcendent. John 1-3 puts it this way. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. So there's a personality injected into the universe. The Greek word here is instructive. It's logos. And according to classical Greek etymology, that is the word, where the word comes from, the Greek means that there is a unifying informational source in the universe. The logos is not a random word, but it exemplifies a self-existing, immanent, transcendent, eternal force that all nature must conform to. And that's the word that John chose to put in there, the logos. It's a special thing. Why is it? It's universal because it's everywhere, this logos. The logos is transcendent. It's not part of nature. It's information coming from outside. It is eternal. Doesn't change. It's unchanging. And it's imminent. Now, what does imminent mean? Imminent, I am. Imminent means it's accessible to all of us. We can understand this. The nomad in the desert can understand in the beginning God created. And the same is with us in that faith. Now, the creation in Genesis 1:1 is also a special word, bara. It occurs in relationship to God in certain places. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. We saw that occurs from nothing. But it occurs again in verse 21 when conscious life is created. And it occurs one more time in verse 27 when God creates man. So when God creates from nothing, he creates matter, and then he created later conscious life and then human life, where it has a direct connection to him in a special way. And Justin will be taking that up on a later time. Now, what happened to our thing? Ah, I'm back. God's creation is also ordered. Now, when I go out in the garage before spring cleaning, before Cheryl cleans it up, there's stuff everywhere. Or you go in your kid's room, right? There's stuff everywhere. What do you do with the stuff? You start to separate it. Engineers, when they approach a problem, big mess, they separate it into component parts. Look at what God does in Genesis 1:1. He separates. There was a mess at the beginning, because in verse 2, we find that the earth was formless and void, and there was darkness over the surface of the deep. So it's formless and void, kind of like my kid's room. Okay, there's like junk everywhere, right? So he finds a state, and what does he do? He starts separating. He's a good engineer. Verse 4, separates light from the darkness. Verse 7, separates waters from above and below the heavens, creating the troposphere that we live in. Verse 9, separates waters and seas from the dry land, okay, and sets those boundaries. We see in Job, he says, this far do your proud waves go, and here they stop. God set those boundaries. He makes separation so that we can use it with profit. Verse 12, separation of different types of life, different types of vegetables. Verse 18, separates day from night to give us the seasons, to give us diurnal variation so that we can live a life that is coherent in night and days unless you work the night shift at the hospital. And finally, in verse 26, he separates man to rule, to have dominion. So we learn about God from these things. God is a reasonable God. He is intelligent. He's coherent. And I say that in a reverential, very reverent way, that God is reasonable. Not that he reasons like us, but that he's accessible through reason because he is a reasonable God. But he is not subject to his creation. All that we experience here in the physical world is a derivative of his word. Look at how Genesis 1 is laid out. Every verse, and God said, and God said, and God said. That's the logos injecting information into what he's made. The separation of all these things, light from darkness, types of life, show that he is organized. But he's not organized in a cold, forgive me, engineers, cold, heartless, pen in the pocket protector way. He's organized with whimsy, with personality, after himself. And we'd love to see that. Okay, so what's the soccer ball doing up here? We're getting that. See, it's our science lesson for today. God made his creation complete. Look at Genesis chapter 2, verse 1. The heavens and earth were completed and all their hosts. And by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from his work which he had created and made. He created it good. Whose standard did he use to create good? His own standard. It's higher than your standard and mine. And it's complete in the sense, like the first law of thermodynamics says, that matter is neither created nor destroyed. He created during this time, he rested the seventh day, he's not making more energy, making more things. But what the universe he's made is dynamic. It is not a museum piece to be set aside for no one ever to look at and never to change. Because he injected something called time. Time, can anyone tell me what time is without using the word? It's really hard. But how about this? We can do this. What is the definition of 1 second? Anybody know? It's a fixed period of time, but there's a scientific definition. It has to do with this. Okay, so suppose I'm a hydrogen atom, and this is a proton. The electron, then it circles around it, and I know you Intel people out here, I know this isn't really how it works, but this is the closest we can make so our minds can understand it, okay? Proton is here. It's a single particle for our purposes. An electron would be about the size of a ping pong ball. The ping pong ball orbits around this with a fixed level of energy. The average distance for a hydrogen atom would be how far away from the proton? What do you think? You're a scientist. Take a guess. Gabe, give us a shot. No idea, okay. It's. I measure distance and how far I am from fast food places. So from this corner to the Tannisborn Chick-fil-A, about 5 miles as the crow flies, is the average distance that this is gonna be far away. God made the hydrogen atom out of a little bit of stuff and a lot of energy. This electron is at certain energy states that are very fixed. There's nothing relative about relativity. This thing can be measured very carefully. So what's this have to do with time? This thing on the right is a cesium clock. And the definition of 1 second is, with a cesium atom having energy level changes of the electron shell over it, 9,200,000,000 oscillations per second. That's the definition. And there's a little change with that. I know it's not exactly right, but that's how we measure. But we can't even conceive of a universe that doesn't have some activity, because without something happening, there would be no time. So God did not make a static universe. The protons are moving, the electrons are moving, there's constant activity. Why is that important? Because look what God did next. He made the universe, but he put us in it. So it's complete, but it's not static, it's dynamic. Look at chapter 1, God made man and said to him, be fruitful and multiply. That's activity, that's dynamic. You're making new relationships. He's using you to make new people. Okay, so that's a change that's occurring in what he's made. God placed the man in the garden, and he said, you be the tender of the garden. You take care of this planet. You have dominion over it. So although creation is complete, there's still a purpose that God has, a teleology in history that's still going forward, and you and I are part of it. Very exciting to be a part of that. Creation reflects the glory of God. If you chanced upon about this in a garage sale, you'd be pretty lucky, right? What can you tell me about the creator of this violin? He's dead. Yeah, he's dead. That's good. He's dead. But he's so skillful. And what things are important to him? Physical beauty, visual beauty, intonation, the timbre of the pitch, the thickness of the wood, all these details come together, tells you that this person loved music, right? And we learn that at the pinnacle of creation is mankind. We were created in God's image, and I'll leave this to Justin to flesh in, except to say that we reflect some of what God wants us to know about himself. That he put a little part of us, himself, in us so we could know what he is like. And it's a daunting thing to know. But he didn't leave us without evidence. We're told, oh, there's no evidence for God. In one sense, proving God is an issue that is a philosophical difficulty. But the Bible is very clear that there is evidence there and we're held responsible for it. In Job 12:7, we're put to the test because Job questions God, and God says back, hey, I'm here. How do you know that I'm here? Just ask the beasts, let them teach you, or the birds of heaven, let them tell you, or speak to the earth, let it teach you, and let the fish of the sea declare to you. Who among these does not know that the hand of God has done this, in whose hand is the breath of every living being and the breath of all mankind? Next verse. Doesn't the ear test words? Doesn't your tongue taste the food? Look what I've done. Ask the animals. They can tell you who did this. And God says there is evidence. In John 20, Thomas goes and says, Lord, I'm not going to believe unless I put my fingers where I saw the scars. Reach here your finger, Jesus says. See my hands. Reach here your hand and put it in my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. We can have faith because of evidence. We can have faith when there is evidence. But God also says, you've seen me and believe, that's great. But blessed are those who did not see and yet believe. That's all of us in this room. But God did leave us other evidence for us. And Paul says this emphatically in 1 Corinthians. God is a God who is reasonable. And Paul says, you know, if the dead are not raised, then Christ is not raised. And if Christ is not raised, you're still in your sins. Your faith is futile. Furthermore, we're found to be false witnesses about God. And above all men, most to be pitied because we're leading you astray. And he put the test to it. He said early in the chapter, verse 6, he says, hey, you don't believe me? There's still 500 people out here who saw him alive. You go ask them. There's empirical evidence for this. Faith is important, but faith is not all we have. God gives us evidence, and he does it in design too. Is God dead? Most science is not done by the formal scientific method. Most of it is done through inference. What's the definition of inference? Inference is conclusions reached by evidence and reason. Okay, not a proof, but it's a conclusion reached by evidence and reason. I know there's rock climbers here, and Cheryl's a rock climber too. This is Smith Rock. She's up halfway up the rock that looks like a monkey's head. Okay, actually she doesn't. She can't do that. But you could believe that the wind and the rain over thousands and maybe millions of years has blown the rock into this configuration that looks like a monkey's face, right? Perfectly reasonable. But if you get in your car and drive on I-84 about 1,200 miles, and you get into the Black Hills and you see that rock formation, you would say reasonably that the wind and the rain over thousands of millions of years blew that into that configuration, right? There are criteria we can use to discern when design has been present. And William Paley said this. He's another one of these bright British guys who is also a theologian. And he said, if I was walking across a heath, that's a meadow, and I tripped over a stone, I would guess that stone had been there since forever. But if I stepped over a watch, I would wonder who made it. He goes, it bears every evidence of design. Okay? And so he allowed for the empirical discussion of design. Now, his critics of the day said, oh, you're going too far with this because the human body is nothing like a machine. That's actually what was said. David Hume said, this is all wrong. Your analogy is all wrong because you're nothing like a machine. But I would say we are machines of the highest order. And this is one of the pumps we use to temporarily do the work of the heart. It's an implantable pump. It's called a HeartMate 2. It spins at about 5,000 RPM, where the little computer brain can figure out how fast to spin it. And it's implanted in patients who have a failing heart and can temporarily assist them. We've left it in for, I just saw a gentleman in the office who has his now for 10 years. He's 10 years out and still going. I recognized him by the little battery pack he was carrying down the hallway. But there's the heart, that's the apex of the left ventricle, and this is placed in there to assist the heart in pumping blood. The heart has to pump about two big railroad cars worth of blood every day. That's how much work your heart does. You don't even know it. You don't send it a Valentine's thank you card or anything, and it just keeps going and doesn't quit. But this one is failing. We put a machine in it, and our machine that we put in is no comparison to the real thing. This is a heart that we've taken from a donor and we're transporting for the purpose of transplant. This is atraumatic to the blood. It never runs out of energy. It does not get tired. You do not have to tell it how fast to beat or what to do. It knows because it talks to the rest of your body. That's something our machines cannot do. But this is preferred by us in every instance to have a biological substitute for your heart rather than a mechanical one. We, our smartest engineers, cannot come up with anything that is even close to the real thing. The same goes for our vision. When you have a 4K television, how many pixels is that? Okay, it's 3,800 across the bottom, 2,100 this way. It's about 8.3, I'm told, million pixels, little bits. How many pixels does your eye have? 6 billion. It's in the order of 1,000 times more higher precision than what you get from the highest television you can get. So is there any evidence for design? I think there is, because when we look at contrivances, devices, an active intelligence is required for any manufactured thing. Why should the artifacts of life be any different, says David Berlinski, who's not a Christian, by the way, but he writes extensively on this subject. So what would Darwin say to that? He has two ways, Darwinists have two ways of saying how we became so complicated. Time plus chance can produce complex life. Now, I'm not going to give biochemistry lessons at 7 p.m., but the odds of this happening are very, very small. Dawkins himself admits it. It's grindingly, creakingly, crashingly obvious that if it were really a theory of chance, it couldn't work. Higgity-piggity luck cannot produce the simplest molecule. Now, the simplest molecule that is common to every nucleated cell is cytochrome C. Cytochrome C is the indispensable protein enzyme that you need in order to metabolize oxygen, okay? Nobody lives, not a single cell lives without cytochrome C. Cytochrome C is a protein that has 100 pieces to it. Now, the way it works is, there we go. It's as if you have Scrabble pieces that have to be lined up, okay? And we have to line them up in a certain order, 100 of them, to get cytochrome C. This is imagining that each building block of protein, which is an amino acid, is like an alphabet letter. There's about 20 that are biologically active. So it's a valid analogy to a Scrabble game. I'm not real good at Scrabble, but I'll tell you, I can take a long time for my turn, because just like in biology, you can't put random letters out and expect to get past Cheryl, because she'll make me look it up in the dictionary and I'll lose my turn. right? In nature, you have to get it right. Cytochrome C is 100 of these in a row that are exactly right, or the thing doesn't work. That sentence, all carbon on Earth exists as amino acids, is 100 spaces and letters, okay? So to get this by accident, let's do a thought experiment. Let's make the entire Earth into amino acids, into Scrabble pieces, microscopic Scrabble pieces, and let's have them mixed together at the maximal chemical rate. And let's wait a billion years. What are the chances that by chance you'll assemble a cytochrome C molecule, 100 amino acids? Because we always think like, oh, if you wait long enough, you shake this long enough, you're going to get something, right? It turns out that someone's calculated this. It's this number 10 to the negative 65th. Now, that means nothing to me, okay? Some of you engineers here may say, oh, that means something. But here's what it means to me. It means that you've won the lottery 8 times in a row. Okay, not you've been trying for a billion years 8 times in a row. You've won, you get one chance and you win 8 times in a row. Now, someone might still say to me, oh, Gary, I mean, it's still a chance, right? I said, yeah, it's still a chance. But if someone in Oregon, say, won the lottery 8 times in a row, what would you suspect? Yeah, you better look at it. So a reasonable person would not accept one person winning 8 times in a row, and we shouldn't either. There's a further problem behind that, because it's also the case that this 100 amino acid protein is coded for in the library of the cell ahead of time. It was there before. This is evidence of what God spoke. God said, and God said, he spoke information into the universe, and this is one of the ways he did it. Your DNA is the library of your cell, and it has the secret code or the programming for the cytochrome C molecule. It precedes the cytochrome C molecule, which is necessary for life. How much information is in the DNA that's in every one of your cells? Well, there's about 6 billion base pairs, okay? That's a big number. For perspective, 200 times less information is found in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And if you found one of those assembled by accident, you'd be pretty amazed. But your genetic code has that much more information. Not only does it have that information, but parts of it are turned on and off as your body needs it in order to react to external stimuli. Bill Gates himself, no stranger to computers, said DNA is like a computer program. Microsoft Office has 30 million lines of code. That's a lot. I wouldn't want to have to sift through it. But that still is dwarfed by the information in each one of your cells, 6 billion base pairs. So Stephen Meyer is a fellow with the Discovery Institute, and he says that DNA shows the need for an intelligent designer because it has information content. Now, this is not an opinion. When we argue from analogy, like, oh, look at this pump, it looks really complicated. Oh, the heart is complicated. Yeah, it's pretty compelling. But here we have quantitative evidence that shows that information science rules out the chance that this occurred by accident. We're not arguing just from analogy, but we're making an inference, that is reason, right, and evidence. Inference is reason plus evidence, and that's what we're doing with this. So Darwin says, well, okay, time plus chance can't do it, but what about natural selection? Natural selection could do it because we know that the fittest survive, right? How does it work? You kind of know what's going to happen, right? The survival of the fittest is something called a tautology, T-A-U-T. O-L-G-Y, tautology. A tautology is a nonsense statement because it adds no information. Because the fittest survive, right? So survival is defined by who's the fittest, and if you're fit, then you survive. So there's no added information. In fact, natural selection only destroys information. It does not create anything new. The ibex dies and does not make a new ibex that's better. Natural selection does not create or innovate, it only destroys. Think of it this way. Fred Hoyle is a cosmologist, a statistician, a scientist, who said, you know, what if I put a cyclone through a junkyard. Could I get an airplane? He said, yeah, maybe you get a Wright Flyer like that. Now let's set the tornado onto this plane. What's going to happen? I'm going to get a 747, right? This defies the laws of thermodynamics. You cannot get this without adding information, coherent information, into the system. You don't get a 747 from that. And so what does man say? Dawkins says this: the greatest challenge to the human intellect over the centuries has been to explain how complex, improbable, that's understating, the appearance of design in the universe arises. It looks like it's designed, he's saying. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the impression of being designed for a purpose. They sure do. But you see what's happening here. It's not a problem of intellect. It's the problem of what we'll allow at the beginning. And Einstein had the same problem. Every line of physical evidence and his own theories of general relativity told us that the universe started from nothing, from a singular point, that the universe had a beginning. I'm not here to tell you when that was or debate that, except that all available lines of evidence show that there was a beginning. And Einstein said, no, there can't be, because it looks too much like Genesis. I don't want it to be like that. So he changed his formulas that he had derived correctly and added a cosmological constant to it. And then all of a sudden, everything didn't work. Your cell phone doesn't work and the GPS doesn't work if he adds it in. Because he didn't want the universe to be like that. He said something that the other scientists didn't want to hear. God does not play dice with the universe. Stephen Hawking, the most famous scientist and most lauded scientist of his generation, early in his career, not later, so don't misquote me on this, early in his career, was studying black holes and came across the stunning conclusion that you can't get something from nothing. And with Roger Penrose, wrote this paper. And in the comments, it says, if mass exists, that is, reality is there, and Einstein was right, and all his empirical evidence shows that it works, your cell phone and GPS show that relativity works, then space and time must be created by some causal being that transcends or operates out of space and time. Let's think about this. A causal being that can do something that operates outside of space and time. Fred Hoyle said, it's as if a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. Does anybody have a candidate for a causal being, a force that acts, that's outside of space and time, and has monkeyed with the physics to make it his own? What does God say? He says, I am God, there is no one like me, in Isaiah. I am God, there is no other, who declares the end from the beginning, from ancient times, things not yet done, right? That my will be established, that I will accomplish my purpose. That's what God says. And he agrees with all the church fathers. There can be perfect harmony between Bible, reason, and science because God is both the author of the Bible and its creator. And this has been the understanding all through the birth of science as well. Newton acknowledged the same. The most beautiful system of sun, planets, comets can proceed only from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. Francis Collins, recently retired head at NIH, the top scientist in the U.S., says this: everything we learn about the natural world only increases our awe of God the Creator. God has left evidence of his design. There is design, and we're held responsible for it. We know that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. It's not a problem with intellect. That philosopher I showed you before who said, oh, science is all there is, was a lifelong friend of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and on his deathbed, his friend, the archbishop, came to him and said, Bernie, you're going to meet your maker soon. What are you going to say to him? You've been an atheist all these years. And he said, I'm going to shake my fist at him and say, you didn't give me enough evidence. It sounds good on this side of the veil, but in God's presence, I would be a little more cautious with that, because the statement in Romans, which you know well, tells that God's divine attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature, are clearly seen through what has been made, so that we are without excuse. The heavens do tell the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the works of his hands. And at the same time, the law of the Lord is perfect, restores the soul. He's revealed himself both through his created physical world and also in his word. His precepts are sure. Charles Spurgeon said this, and we'll close. The highest science, the loftiest speculation, the mightiest philosophy which can ever engage a child of God is the name, the nature, the person, the work, the doings, and the existence of the great God who he calls his Father. Let's go to him in prayer. Lord, thank you for showing us your glory and what you've made. Lord, you've shown us how much you love us, that you didn't spare your own son. But in what you made, Lord, you've shown your power, your glory, your attention to detail, and your love for us. Lord, humbly we return this praise to you. Thank you for being our God and our Father. In Jesus' name.